there, or extra cushions if you need it. Be comfortable. It's really what practice is about. Becoming more essentially comfortable in our skin and in our own conditions. How to relax and not resist. I'd like to talk today about precepts and the place of precepts in a practice life. They're really an essential part of practice when we're not on the cushion. And so I want to explore this a bit because we're coming up on a ceremony and there's going to be a lot of prep for precept, receiving precepts. So being generous in how we live, and dana or generosity is one of the primary practices that we can take up, that is, we can do it at any moment of our life. Is what is the generosity in this moment that I can offer? So we offer it in our behavior and in our spirit, and it flows naturally from realizing the interdependence of our life with all beings, all things going on. So a life based on a full-on recognition of interdependence and the application that it's really up to us. This is what precepts are about. How we're going to respond to whatever comes our way and what we want to put out into the world, no matter what the world is bringing to us. This is really increasingly challenging. How to respond as a person of the way to a world that is becoming increasingly more distressed, disturbed, reactive, cruel. So our practice is an intention to live consciously and generously. And this intention is nurtured by taking on the precepts. And there are many people in this room who have, and there are a number of people who are about to take on the first 5 precepts of the 16. So I wanted to share with you lines that cap the precept ceremony. When living beings receive the precepts of the fully awakened ones, they promptly enter the dwelling of the myriad sages. This place is the same as great awakening. This is truly to be children of the Buddha. These lines are in formal Buddha speak, really. The language is kind of formal. And whenever we use formal language, one of the things that implies is pay attention to this. This is really important. We don't say it in the usual casual way because this is not a casual matter. When living beings receive the precepts of the fully awakened ones, can everybody hear me, by the way? Yeah? They promptly enter the dwelling of the myriad sages, the wise ones. This place of a life of precepts is the same as great awakening. So living according to the precepts is great awakening. And this is truly to be children of the Buddha, to come into our Buddha maturity, our Buddha mind and heart as mature human beings. So when we take up the precepts, we're using them to help us be present, to be really present to our interdependence. And to be a truly mature human being is, in a different language set, is to know what benefits the tribe. And in Buddhism, the tribe is all beings, large and small, seen and unseen. All the beings we know and all those we don't know who are also part of our lives. And there are many more beings that are part of our lives that we don't know and we're not aware of than that we know. So since during the coming weeks, a number of you are preparing to receive precepts, it's fitting that we take this up today, the importance of the precepts in our life of practice. First of all, it's unlikely that we're going to be able to meditate when our lives are in upheaval because of our own carelessness, our own careless behavior, and mindless reactive behavior. Meditation where mind and body are being nurtured in stillness and openness, requires that we put aside thinking, that we don't follow thinking, although thoughts come up, as we know, but that's not our concern at the moment. And instead we dwell entirely in the present moment, whatever it is bringing up, which is why I mentioned during our sit, you know, there are so many impulses that I've noticed in my own sitting that come up when I'm meditating. They can arise from body sensations that are rather uncomfortable, or thoughts, or some belief. But anger and resentment and regret and anxiety all get in the way of easeful abiding. So if we really get caught up in those thoughts and memories and situations in our lives, and we all have them all the time that are unsettling, if we engage in those mentally during meditation, we cannot relax deeply into easeful abiding. So the tool that we use to reflect on our disrupted mind states and heart, mind and body and heart, that lead us around and get us caught in strong emotion and insistent thoughts, the tool that we can use is precepts. During meditation or not, precept practice. So when something's really bothering us, it can be extremely useful to think, well, what are the precepts involved here? Because when we don't act according to the guidance of the precepts, there is disturbance that arises. So precepts are not absolutes. They're not absolutes. If we hold them as absolutes, then we fall into the hell realm of fundamentalism, where anything that departs from our idea of an ideal is wrong and off, which is a primary separation from the true nature of things. So they are instead reliable guides to how to use our body, speech, and mind. What to keep in mind as we live our daily lives. It just guides, things to think about, ways to reflect before we respond to something if we are not quite sure what we want to do. What is the precept involved here? And then that helps us choose how to respond. We don't always have the time, the mental time or the actual time at work or whatever, to think so thoroughly. But that's why we use them as a very important part, one of the three legs of practice. So we want to look at the importance of precepts and how they function as an essential ingredient in the transformative power of this practice. This practice, for a long time, we translate our experience into Buddha language. But when we live this life over time, it is thoroughly transformative. And what does it transform? It transforms our life as a suffering human being to one who, in the most essential way, no longer suffers. That doesn't mean we don't have difficulties, because difficulties is the first noble truth. Those are conditions, of course. And yes, we have our reactions to them, but we know the nature of our reactions. So that's the liberative step that happens through consistency, constancy of practice. So these precepts are not just ideas, it's a way of life. And practicing with precepts generates the heat that forges and inspires our social, political, and intimate behaviors. Precepts are especially urgent now when we act as a member of the collective. We need to stand up and speak out about things that are going on, but in a way that is consistent with nurturing life, kindness, and maintaining connection, even with those people who are most difficult for us. So our ordinary human experience in samsara samsara is the realm of desire and clinging. Does everybody know that word? I think just everybody here are long-time practitioners. So when we are caught in samsara, in our samsaric selves, when we're caught, we behave according to our preferences and our aversions and a very dualistic view of self and other. Me is against the world. That's the samsaric position. A world that revolves around desire, and desire revolves around the idea that there's something missing. There's just so much to say about this. That's a whole other theme. But the second noble truth is the source of suffering, and that is desire and clinging. So here's a quote from Bhikkhu Bodhi, who I recommend if you do reading on various questions. Bhikkhu Bodhi is a reliable and deeply practiced wise man. So he says, the initial response the Buddha intends to arouse in us is an ethical one. So when we think about Buddhism is a religion because it has all of the things that religions have, but it's basically an ethical inquiry. By calling our attention to our bondage to old age and death, he seeks to inspire in us a firm resolution to turn away from unwholesome ways of living and to embrace instead wholesome alternatives. So these are the words that we use, the concepts that we use to look at what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. So wholesome is always based on that which is not impermanent, and unwholesome is based on that which is impermanent. So anything wholesome grows out of an awareness of the deepest truth of emptiness, of openness, that there is no fixed quality thing. Nothing is fixed. Everything is always in motion and interdependently arising. And also unwholesome is what we get caught in something and think it's permanent. So going on with his quote, the notion of a skillful desire may sound strange, but a mature mind intuitively pursues the desires it sees as skillful and drops those it perceives as not. Basic in everyone is the desire for happiness. So very often people will say when we're in Dharma discussions, well, wait a minute, isn't it a desire to be awake, a desire to meditate, to be free of suffering? Isn't that desire still? And yes, it is. And so the Buddha doesn't deny that it's desire, but it's wholesome desire because it leads to freedom from suffering. And then Bhikkhu Bodhi goes on to say, every other desire is a strategy for attaining that happiness. You want an iPod, a sexual partner, or an experience of inner peace because you think it'll make you happy. Because these secondary desires are strategies, they follow a pattern. They spring from an inchoate feeling of lack and limitation. So that's really, that's so important to keep this in mind, that, you know, that phrase, there's nothing missing. There's nothing missing. This moment is complete. But I'm really hungry. Oh, then probably seeking food is a wholesome thing to do to maintain the life that you have been given to serve all beings, right? So we are always seeking the cause of our feeling of limitation and using our powers of creative imagination to conceive a solution to it. It's really true. I mean, that's how we go. That's how we do it. Whatever the desire, if the solution actually leads to happiness, the desire is skillful. Well, a lot of desires lead to happiness and are not necessarily skillful. I mean, if your life revolves around alcohol, drinking alcohol, then you're going to be happy when you see that bottle of scotch on the shelf. You have a drink and you go, ah, this is bliss. But in the long run, that is not. So you want to see what are the limitations of that? That's not permanent. As soon as we get something that we desire, the first thing we want to do is hold on to it or get more of it. So then that kind of is a clue that this is not entirely wholesome. This dissatisfaction continues. So whatever the desire, if the solution actually leads to happiness, the desire is skillful. What made the Buddha special was that he never lowered his expectations. He imagined the ultimate happiness, one so free from limit and lack that it would leave no need for further desire. That's just so well said. That's exactly it. And then treasured his desire for that happiness as his highest priority. And then, of course, the Bodhisattva way is not only do you desire your own realization of ultimate happiness, but you desire it for all beings. Because once you're open and relieved that way, there is no reason not to offer that to all beings, because we are all capable of freeing ourselves from whatever gets in the way of this kind of ease and joyful way of living. So unskillful desire is the cause of suffering. Skillful desire forms part of the path to its cessation. We'll be having a five precept ceremony and a refuge ceremony in November, November 10th. And some of you will be receiving the five precepts and one of you will be receiving the 16. And when you take the 16 precepts, which is called Jukai, you're committing to use your life to serve all beings. And that's when you get a Dharma name and you have sewn a rakusu, which is what this little bib thing is. So these ceremonies are commitments. They're commitments to practice and require a lot of preparation, not just internal. The internal preparation is always ongoing. We're always preparing with the precepts for the next moment of our life, basically. But the ceremony comes, which requires study, and we have Antetsu will be leading the class on the five precepts, and it requires reflection, of course, and sewing. Lots of sewing, which can be very, very challenging. And Jiden is our sewing instructor and helps everyone with those stitches. So precepts, or sila, ethics, is part of the threefold training in Buddhism. which is precepts, meditation, and study. And each of them help the others potentialize. And they all support a life of a certain way of living our lives that comes down to us from Shakyamuni and through millions of others of our ancestors. And actually, Buddhism, in a way, is a sensitivity training, basically. It's a sensitivity training. When we open the mind and the heart, we are much more sensitive to what is making up every experience in the moment. And we are much more vulnerable. We develop and cultivate sensitivity to the minute and subtle play of experience and action. And we come to notice even ever more minutely the play of cause and effect. And that immediately puts us in a position of being way responsible for our own actions. As soon as we are educated in what leads to what, we take on the responsibility and say, all right, I'm ready for this. We develop sensitivity to our behaviors and what they lead to, and how they lead to either suffering or happiness in ourselves and in others. And in a way, the precepts are an ancient form of cognitive behavioral therapy. Because really, it's our thoughts and our actions create our experience. The Buddha was a great, he really understood kind of the essential human trap of consciousness and how to free ourselves from it. But we are in a very, very different cultural setting now than he was 2,500 years ago. And I've been saying this a lot recently, but I think Zen in America is recognizing that we need to do a lot more education on a psychological level about how we carry on. We have a lot of insight and skill and variability in how we can work with the things that get in the way of our deeply embedded behaviors. Because we behave not just from our own limited self, but we behave from the ancients of biological lineage and cultural lineages. We carry the trauma. So this is, Dharma is becoming much more trauma-informed. There was no such thing as trauma recognized and linguistically referred to in the time of the Buddha. But now we see there's trauma all over the place, and there has been for millennia. And trauma is carried in the physiological self in ways that we begin to recognize as we practice much more. We see much more minutely and subtly when reactivity strikes up, that it's referring to stuff that is not particularly about what's going on now, but it has a certain commonality with it. So it gets complicated, and we develop an ability to discern much more in a much more refined way as we go. So precepts instruct us and remind us also to be mindful of our deepest intention, to be awake and kind and generous, and behave accordingly. So how do you be kind with somebody who's really giving you a pain in the butt? Mm-hmm. That's very challenging. It takes a deeply grounded sense of agency to maintain your own integrity in very, very challenging situations and not to follow the tone that is being offered, right? So they remind us of how essential it is that we attend to our life with care and compassion. So now I'd like to just briefly go through the five precepts. Do not kill but cherish all life. Do not kill but cherish all life. The Zen Peacemaker Order version of this is recognizing that I am not separate from all that is. This is the precept of non-killing. So it's always true that if we are identified with our narrow separate self, this precept is one thing. If we are identified with and recognize our interdependence with all of life, this precept becomes way, way more challenging to keep. So in our ordinary life, most of us are not in the habit of killing. We don't kill humans, and most of us don't kill animals. But what about insects? Especially the small ones and the ones that buzz in your ear. And now, lately, we're really coming to appreciate the essentialness of insects to our lives and the great web of maintenance of life, right? But they also carry new diseases. So this is not a simple good or bad kind of a precept. None of the precepts are simple. They're endlessly complex. Also, what about vegetarianism? I'm just going to raise some of the questions here, not particularly address them, but that's another question, is how do we approach what we eat? Because vegetables are as much life as cows. How do we approach paying our taxes when we are so involved in a system that funds killing in many, many different ways? How about capital punishment? Or killing the spirit of a child and how we respond to them, or our coworkers or our spouses. So there's a lot in relation to this precept that we can really rethink a lot of our behaviors as a family member, as a consumer, as a citizen. Then the second of the five is refrain from taking what is not given, being satisfied with what we have, not having thoughts of gain and loss or something missing. And this runs through our lives constantly. Most of us don't steal or commit grand larceny or shoplift, but do you acknowledge when you've been given too much change? How else does this theme of stealing come up in our lives? We can look at the environmental situation in terms of this precept. What is offered to us? What is offered to us? Oil? Water? How do we use it? Anything that can be depleted and used up results in harm to ourselves and all creative being gets interfered with. We know we have no excuse when we know the truth of interdependence. And this is really, if we really pay attention to what's going on, I think this was said during the Friday gathering at CHS at the walkout. Several students gave talks, and as did one professor. And they said, "Don't tell me how you think, show me what you do." And so we can all think about, okay, what are we doing? Where is plastic in our lives, and how are we ducking out of that? You know, every product that we buy is in a container, just about. So how are we going to relate to that? As consumers only, or as citizens? As citizens, we can really make a difference if we address that with the companies that make the containers and continue to sell things in plastics. Anyway, I don't want to get too carried away there. Another form of this is bullying, which is a kind of stealing someone else's power, someone else's sense of safety or dignity or self-respect. And then what this leads to, not taking what's not offered, is beginning to cultivate what we call our way of eating in Zen, Oryoki, which means just enough. So how do we begin to live with just enough? What is just enough? What is enough? And that's also part of working with this precept in our lives. Frugality. You know, we always think of somebody as frugal. I don't know, I grew up around a mixed message about frugality. On the one hand, it's really prudent, and on the other hand, it's a little stingy. So what? How are we going to relate to that? But just being aware of this theme. Then the third one is refrain from false speech and manifest the truth. And there are different kinds of lying. There's exaggeration. There's fudging. Just a little fudging. There's dissembling, which is giving a false or misleading appearance to something. Concealing the truth or the real nature. To dissemble one's incompetence in business. To conceal one's true motives, thoughts, by some pretense. We all have lots of examples of this in our public sphere, but we all also engage in it in various ways. Dogen says, the whole universe is moistened with nectar, and the truth is ready to harvest. So we need to look at, what is the truth? What is the truth here? We have a world that is very confused about what truth is. And no need to make things different from what they are. What lies behind when we have to say something that is not true, to make something different? Or when we make unsubstantiated claims, or we say we know something and we don't actually know it. It's hearsay. And then also including in false speech or manifesting the truth is listening and speaking. How we listen deeply to allow the truth to emerge, and how we speak from the heart with care. And then the fourth is refraining from sexual misconduct and being respectful in relationships. This can really tear apart a sangha, and it certainly has torn apart this culture with all of the ancient ways of sexual misconduct that has just been part of how it's been that we're starting to address and say, wait a minute, this can't keep going on. In what ways do you manifest infidelity? This also points to overindulgence in sense pleasures. You know, are you doing that? Is it really good for you to have that second piece of cake? Sometimes. But not all the time. And then, nurturing the sangha, really being aware of how we come across and what underlies our way of being with others. And the fifth is refraining from intoxication and keeping the mind clear. Intoxication clouds the mind, leading to poor judgment and harmful action. Often this is said, not taking drugs and alcohol. Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, sometimes you might want to have a beer on a hot day or with friends. These are not absolutes. However, to be aware of what you're doing and possible harm, and being prudent about how it's used. But intoxication goes way beyond substances, way beyond. And probably the harder things to work with are those intoxicants that are not substances, such as anger, or what else?
YouTube.
What are people?
YouTube,
etc. Yeah.
Enthrallment.
Huh?
Enthrallment.
Enthrallment. Getting very taken away by some particular person or idea or image. Some of us can become quite filled with our own opinions. And this really narrows our ability to stay open and in connection with others, to maintain connection. takes a lot of wisdom to, of course we believe in what we believe in, but do we really want what we believe in to get in the way of connection? Because that's when we begin to work together. And we certainly need to know how to get much more skillful about that. So that means being very aware when we are grabbed and enthralled by our opinions. One of the Thich Nhat Hanh precepts, and he's recast these into primary precepts, which are very long, but he says, do not take actions that lead the community to break. So that's what's happened. And that's what's been nurtured at a very public level. It's really, really created tremendous harm to all of us. So that's a subtle one, because you have to talk about things that are really problematic that are going on. But the way that we approach it, we have infinite possible ways of approaching pointing out that something needs to be attended to in our collective life. And doesn't have to come from hatred and disdain, but from recognizing that we're all capable of just about everything, given the right conditions, and maintaining a sense of compassion, while also a nice, cold, hard look at the results of others' behaviors and our own. So that's just a touching in briefly, and we will be looking into precepts much more. The way that we do it in our lineage is we receive five first and live with those, and then the real commitment to the way comes with receiving Jukai, the 16 precepts. And our lives really change when we receive precepts. So it's worth looking into it if you haven't, considering, okay, maybe I'm ready, or I'm not quite ready, because that's fine. There's no pressure to do this. This is all about your own life, your own spiritual practice. Thanks so much for sharing in this. May we all awaken.
Please turn to page 5 of your pamphlet.
Awakening.